Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Events over the past year have shone a light on racial inequality across the globe. Australia is not an exception. This nation's journey towards a more just, equitable and reconciled identity still has a long way to go. With that in mind, and in the spirit of reconciliation, we acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and community. We pay our respects to elders past, present and emerging, and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people today.
Connecting the dots on climate change includes understanding what looks like a slow and steady rise in global temperatures, in fact, has a profound effect on regional variability in weather, increasing risks of increasingly extreme weather conditions. In Australia, we understand extreme weather. From bushfires to floods, droughts and fires, big weather's a big part of our life on a magnificent continent. However, extremes are increasing. The intensity and magnitude are growing, with Black Summer in 2019-2020 a textbook case of how climate change alters our Australian life and landscape. Heat is at the centre of climate change. It's both the core problem, that slowly rising temperature, and a major threat. Heat waves are already the natural disaster that has the highest mortality in Australia, a mortality that's predicted to rise over coming decades. One of the most confronting elements of climate science is the temperature limit that's faced biological life. How close are we to those limits? How much do we understand those limits? And can we both mitigate and adapt quickly enough to ensure our future? My name's Anna-Greta Hunter. I'm a physician and cardiologist, and I'm welcoming you today to the Policy Forum Pod, which is produced by policyforum.net, part of the Crawford School of Public Policy of the Asia Pacific's leading graduate policy school here in ANU. Listeners, you can check out our degree program and our short courses at crawford.anu.edu.au/study. And I'm delighted to be in the virtual studio again with my co-host, Sharon Bessel.
Hi, Anna-Greta. It's great to be here and to be talking about this particular issue or these sets of issues as we lead into COP26.
It is. It's a very important time, I think, for us to be really reflecting on the nature of climate change and climate science. And of course, we're following on in this episode with the reflections from our discussion just recently with Robert Glasser, an episode which I think has been quite well received out there.
Yeah, that was a fantastic episode. We've had a lot of really great feedback on it. And for those of our listeners who haven't yet had a chance to download the pod with Robert, it was a really great introduction into some of the issues around COP, the process itself, and what we need to know to be able to make sense of the discussions and the reporting that will come out of that meeting in the coming weeks. For those of you who don't know me, I'm Sharon Bessel. I'm Professor of Public Policy here at the Crawford School. And over the next few weeks, Anna-Greta, we're going to be having a number of conversations around issues that will be relevant for COP.
Absolutely. It's a tremendously important time for us to be discussing these issues. And so, Sharon, today we have two people joining us to discuss heat in the context of our changing climate. Would you like to introduce our guests?
I would love to. We have two outstanding guests to talk through these issues. And I should just put the warning on this that we are, of course, recording remotely yet again as we are in lockdown here in Canberra. Anna-Greta and I both have brand new microphones, which we hope is going to help with the quality, but we do apologise.
But it doesn't necessarily block, and it doesn't block the chickens and the dogs and the animals and the children that will come through the soundscape from time to time. So listeners, we do beg your indulgence at this interesting time that we all find ourselves
in. We've had a fabulous range of sound effects over the past couple of weeks, which just adds to the excitement of every episode, but we do appreciate people's patience. So today we have with us Simon Quilty. Simon is a general practitioner who trained as an engineer before studying medicine. He has lived and worked in the Northern Territory for over 20 years, and he has a great deal of experience in rural and remote medicine in Australia. Simon is currently based in Alice Springs, and he works as a general physician at the Alice Springs Hospital. He's also a visiting fellow at the Research School of Population Health here at the Australian National University, where his research examines the relationship between environmental heat and well-being, with a focus on the Northern Territory. And his work takes a cultural lens to examine opportunities to adapt to the warming that is now underway in tropical north of Australia. Simon, it's great to have you with us. Welcome.
Thanks, Sharon. Good to be here.
And we also have with us Sarah Perkins Kirkpatrick. Sarah is a climate scientist with a particular interest in extreme events. She's an Australian Research Council Future Fellow and Chief Investigator on the Australian Research Council Centre of Excellence for Climate Extremes. She is currently based in the School of Science at UNSW Canberra. She researches on issues around heat waves, focusing particularly on comprehensive methods of attributing heat waves to climate change. She's also assessing how we might attribute the health impacts of heat waves to climate change. And her research interests cover issues around marine heat waves and their linkages to atmospheric heat waves and past and future changes of these types of events. Sarah, fantastic to have you here today. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Sarah, perhaps we could start with you. And can I ask you to begin by painting the picture of how the global increase in temperature of just over 1 degree has affected temperatures around Australia?
Yeah, so it's not looking very good, can I just say, as much as it pains me to say that. Globally speaking, we've only seen an increase of roughly 1 degree Celsius, just a little bit over, since the Industrial Revolution. In Australia, average temperatures increased by just under 1.5 degrees Celsius since the beginning of the 20th century. So that doesn't sound like a lot, really. You know, if today was a degree warmer, for example, here in Canberra, I'd be much appreciative. But it means a lot for extremes and temperature extremes particularly. So we only need a small change in those average conditions to see a really large increase in both the frequency and intensity of extreme temperatures, such as heat waves or extremely hot days. And that's exactly what we're seeing. So everywhere in Australia has seen an increase in the frequency of heat waves, and most places, particularly in southern Australia, have also seen an increase in the intensity of these heat waves as well. So heat waves are generally extreme heat events that last for at least 3 days in a row. Obviously, we also get temperature extremes that, you know, are just a day or two, and we're also seeing massive changes in them too. So, for example, in Penrith, a suburb in Greater Western Sydney, during the 2019-2020 summer, they actually recorded a temperature of 48.9 degrees Celsius. And there's lots of research coming out now saying that days like 50 degrees Celsius, which are basically unheard of in Australian capital cities, will no longer be the case. And it's looking like that could happen, you know, by halfway through this century as well. So, you know, that's in conjunction with, you know, a larger global increase in average temperature. So, you know, maybe reaching 2 or 3 degrees Celsius will make us see, you know, much, much larger increases in the frequency and severity of temperature extremes compared to what we've seen recently.
Simon, that sounds terrifying when we just think about the increase of the temperature to towards 50 degrees. But for people, for plants, for animals, biological life on this planet, temperature is one factor in heat and humidity is the other. What do we know about the health impacts of heat in particular?
The interesting thing when you start to explore environmental heat is that it's really not, there's not a great deal of consensus on how it harms people. We understand from an epidemiological point of view that heat is attributable to mortality and morbidity rates, but we don't really know the specifics. When you contrast that to things like cancer treatment and, for instance, progress in things like CAR T cell therapy, which is extraordinary understanding of human physiology, we are pretty lackluster in our understanding of how heat affects human bodies. And so I think we've got a long way to go. I think that there's an evolving and great deal of interest in this sphere, but I also think that what it reflects for me personally, particularly where I work and with whom I work, which is mainly Aboriginal people, is that as a society, as a Western society, we are very non-ecological. We think we're non-ecological, but we can't be non-ecological. We are part of this planet. And even when you live in really hot places like Alice Springs or Darwin, you can't escape living in those really hot environments. And so, you know, there's some things that we know clearly, that, for instance, that if your body goes above 41 degrees Celsius, your proteins start to denature and you start to cook, and we call that heat stroke. However, how heat from a shorter and longer-term perspective actually interacts and potentially damages the body is not well understood.
Sarah, I wondered if you wanted like to comment on some of that. I know you've done some work as well looking at the population level on the health impacts of heat.
Yeah, so that sort of work relies basically on what we know from an epidemiological perspective. So depending where you are in the world, and we're starting to scratch the surface here in Australia, but this research is certainly more advanced in other parts worldwide, that depending on where you live, you know, you're acclimatized to a certain temperature range. So, for example, Australians, generally speaking, are acclimatized to warmer temperatures than, say, Northern Europe or England. And we can kind of look at that relationship between extreme temperature or, you know, extremes that might occur and how that might relate to the mortality or morbidity rate of those particular regions. And that can then tell us, you know, we can then look, well, if these extreme heat events are increasing, then the relative effect on human mortality and morbidity will also be affected too. And there's therefore a climate change signal in those relative death rates or things like hospital admissions or incidences of certain diseases as well. So it's certainly, I guess, a new field. As Simon said, you know, we do know some things about extreme heat and how it affects human health, but there's still a lot that we don't know. And then that also kind of impacts what we can actually do in terms of how, you know, changes in extreme heat will change in these impacts as well. But I should add there, like, there's a real need here for both people like myself and Simon and our respective disciplines to work together. It's not easy because we do tend to speak different languages, but this is what we need to do moving forward, that if we really want to understand how population health and heat interact and affect one another, or, you know, really namely how heat affects human health, it's something that we need to do and work together and start speaking the same language. Because that's really, you know, how we're really going to understand how climate change may increase human morbidity and mortality.
Sarah, we know that the global temperature has risen by just over 1 degree on average from 150 years ago as a baseline. There is regional heat variation, and I wonder if you might like to explain to us what regional heat variation might mean in the Australian context. Are we seeing a uniform increase in temperature across our continent?
Yeah, sure. So how changes in the weather play out, whether it's extreme temperature or temperature in general or another type of climate variable such as rainfall or wind or what have you, it's really dependent on the local climate. So, for example, things like the tropics, a temperate climate, an alpine climate, those sorts of things, that really helps govern how changes in the overall global climate will transpire at a local scale. So these changes aren't uniform over Australia, just like they're not uniform over other regions of the globe. Generally speaking, you know, the tropics, based on their very definition, have a really narrow temperature range. They don't vary much in the year. You know, they might range, for example, between 25 and 35 degrees Celsius if you're lucky. So that's a very narrow temperature range. And what is an extreme in the tropics will be different to, say, an extreme in somewhere like Melbourne or Tasmania. So places, more temperate climates, which are places like Melbourne and Tassie and Sydney and Canberra as well, they do have a larger annual variation. And so they tend to actually hit extremes like 40, 45 degrees Celsius, which is not seen in the tropics because of that, you know, smaller temperature range, and also because, you know, the tropics are also more humid and a lot of that extra energy goes into keeping the air humid and the moisture in the air. So that does really govern, you know, how the changes will expire in the future. And it's interesting that when we talk about exceedances of things like extreme heat, the tropics, so places like Darwin, Brisbane, basically anywhere north of 23.5 degrees south, they will see quite a large increase in the frequency of heat waves because it doesn't take much to exceed that relative extreme threshold. You know, if the relative extreme is, say, 33 degrees Celsius and all of a sudden you warm your climate by a couple of degrees, then you're going to see that, you know, that relative frequency be a lot higher than in a temperate climate where they have a much larger distribution over the entire course of the year. So that's something to keep in mind when we're talking about how, you know, changes in average climate then transpire into changes in more specific extreme events.
And Simon, you're currently living in Alice Springs, but you've lived and worked in Katherine for many years in the tropical north of the Northern Territory. Can you tell us a little about your experiences with changing temperatures over the past few decades, and particularly what you've seen in terms of the health impacts of those changes?
Look, I mean, I guess working and living in a predominantly Indigenous community, everything that I've seen has been flavoured by this incredibly different view of how to perceive and interpret the world. But climate change has been recognised in places like Katherine by Indigenous people, regardless or not even informed by meteorologists or science or contemporary conversations around climate change. And, for instance, around these parts, it was thought that the world was getting hotter because the sun was coming lower to the ground. And so what has been, so whilst it's been clear to Indigenous people that the environment's warming up and they've witnessed this and understood it through things like signalling of systems and ecosystems, for instance, flowering of plants and the timing of different ecological events. The last decade, from my perspective, I've been up in the top of the Northern Territory for about 20 years on and off. The last 10 years, and particularly the last 3 or 4 years, have been incredibly hot. And so Katherine is a good example of that. In 2019-20, the summer of 2019-20 was the hottest ever recorded, and I think December average was 4 degrees above the long-term average. There were 56 days above 40 degrees Celsius, which was almost 1,000% increase over the long-term average. From a personal perspective, it was existentially terrifying to realise that the extreme new heat that had arrived so much earlier than people had thought it would was now here to stay. And at the moment we're in La Nina year and we're all kind of sighing relief. But everybody up here is aware that we have very substantial problem on our hands in the next 5 to 10 years.
And so I think, Simon, that resonates with so many of us living in Australia, that the summer of 2019-20, the black summer for those of us on the East Coast, a very hot summer where you were in the Northern Territory, really began to get our attention, I think, about what the future might look like. And that takes us to the future predictions that we see in our climate science. The recent sixth assessment report from the IPCC demonstrates increasing confidence about climate science and climate modelling. Sarah, what sort of predictions can we take from that report for the climate of our future?
Yeah, it's really interesting. So with the most recent IPCC report, you're right. The amount of confidence that they've put in terms of changes in extremes, or not put in, but what the science actually shows us now, has actually increased quite dramatically from previous iterations. So I would say that's probably where the most research over the last number of years has gone into climate science, is this change in extremes. Previous IPCC reports were much more conservative about what we know and what we didn't know about changes in extremes, but that has certainly shifted in the last 8 or so years. And for the most part, the more the climate warms by in terms of a global climate, the worse extremes will be. Now, the relative worseness, I guess, depends on the type extreme that you're looking at. So, you know, for example, the changes in extreme rain events scale differently to global average temperature compared to extreme temperature. But, you know, I would say that the largest changes, or the most, I guess, sensitive changes to global average temperature, are changes in extreme heat. And that's really quite concerning, because this is, you know, just like Simon was mentioning, these are the sorts of extremes that we're all of a sudden experiencing a lot more of. They're only going to get worse, and they have massive implications, obviously, for our human health, but also for many other different systems as well. And the IPCC have really come out with quite strong statements around that, not only around those you know, changes and impacts, but what we actually need to do to mitigate those changes. And it's a really, you know, it's really going to be hard to do that, and is, you know, in many ways probably off the table now.
So I think that might be a place for us to take a very short break to contemplate the future of our planet, and we'll be back in just a moment.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Around the world, democracies are in crisis. Leaders have become followers. Populists offer glib solutions to complex problems, and people search for answers. Block out the noise. Each week on Democracy Sausage, we go deeper to bring you insights from leading scholars, journalists and commentators to help you make sense of the world. I'm Mark Kenny from the Australian National University. Join me at the Democracy Sausage Hot Plate every Monday and Thursday.
So, welcome back. We're here with Simon Quilty and Sarah Perkins Kirkpatrick talking about heat and the health impacts of climate change. Before the break, we looked into the future of temperatures around the world and in Australia. It is a confronting view, with increasing frequency of extreme heat and temperatures that we've had little experience in handling. The politics of international climate negotiations, I think, can seem stark in contrast, with negotiations that involve a compromise in the temperature rise expected over the next century between a best-case scenario of 1.5 degrees and then scenarios that range above 3 degrees. What sorts of temperatures will we be seeing in Australia, even at the best-case scenario? Sarah, I wonder if you could give us a taste of the sorts of temperatures we might be experiencing in either case over the next few decades.
Yeah, definitely. So I just want to kind of say there that my viewpoint, even as a, you know, person in climate science, I've been studying and working in climate science since I left high school almost 20 years ago. My view on what is possible, or my understanding of what is possible in Australia, has changed dramatically over the last couple of years, simply because of events that have transpired worldwide. So I actually had a friend over on the day that Perth reached 48.9 degrees Celsius. I was living in Western Sydney at the time, and they asked me when would Sydney hit 50 degrees Celsius. And at the time I thought, oh, there's no way we're going to reach, you know, the high 40s today. It'll be another few decades or so. And I actually have to, you know, I messaged him back that night and said, I've got to, you know, give you a different answer, because we're only a degree or so off it now. And that was in a summer where we didn't have El Nino, which is usually a driver of really hot weather in most of Australia. That wasn't in its active phase. So if you get, you know, in the near term, the perfect storm of climate change, climate variability and drought, those temperatures are very, very, very possible. And I'm actually quite surprised that we didn't actually reach them during our Black Summer fire. And that's also cemented by what happened in Canada in the town of Lytton in June this year. That town, Lytton, sits at the same latitude as London, and it reached almost 50 degrees Celsius. And that even, you know, shocked me. It didn't surprise me, but it was a massive shock to think a city at such high latitude reaching such a high temperature when we've only warmed by 1 degree Celsius globally. It was a huge, I wouldn't say it's a wake-up call, but it's a huge reality check of what we can, you know, reach in Australia in the short term. So certainly temperatures of around 50 degrees Celsius are not off the table in the next couple of decades. Currently, it does take that perfect storm of climate variability, climate change, and local scale processes for that to transpire. But moving into the future, it will be climate change that will be the dominant factor. And the more we warm by, the more likely those extreme temperatures will be and the more often that they'll occur. So if we warm by 5 degrees Celsius, for example, you can expect that summers in Sydney, summers in your capital city, will it be experiencing days of 50 degrees Celsius reasonably regularly. The chance of that is less at, say, 2 degrees warming, but it's definitely not impossible. I'd still reckon it's going to happen at 2 degrees Celsius, just not as often, obviously, at a warming of 5 degrees Celsius.
Simon, we've talked a little bit about the health impacts of extreme heat, but what are the limits of biological survivability when we start to talk about 50 degree days as being relatively regularly?
One of the things about heat and human research is that we have all these confounders of housing and infrastructure and technology. So the early research on heat and biology started with dairy cows. When you work in the Northern Territory, you can see how important it is for people to have infrastructure that allows them to shelter from these really extreme climates. And I guess what I am seeing up here is that if nothing changes around Indigenous housing and extreme poverty, then I feel like those communities are certainly coming to the point. In fact, they have come past the point of these extreme temperatures. And there's definitely people dying in the Northern Territory from heat exposure because they simply can't shield from the heat. So, for instance, we've got some research coming out that demonstrates the extreme energy poverty of remote living Indigenous people. And when you consider that the housing in which they reside is incredibly substandard, it would shock an audience from Canberra to see the standards of some of these houses that are not insulated, often built from tin. So when you get a 50-degree day, so it hasn't ever reached 50 degrees in Tennant Creek, for instance, but it got to 49.9 in 2019, the inside of a house is poorly designed and constructed could presumably go up to well above 50 degrees Celsius, just the same as leaving a child in a car. And so when people don't have the capacity to pay for air conditioning of these poorly designed spaces, then we're very close to a limit of survivability, keeping in mind that we know that proteins start to denature about 40 degrees Celsius and that heat stroke hits at 41 degrees Celsius. And knowing, for instance, that Alice Springs experienced an unprecedented 40 days above 40 degrees Celsius in a row a few years ago, it's really now foreseeable that we are going to have summers in the next decade that will potentially lead to a very significant public health crisis.
Right, and I would have to, you know, agree with that. It's heat seems to be an insidious killer that no one can, you know, they don't see. It doesn't happen straight away, so it's not really obvious when it might occur. And I do think people don't realise that, you know, as mentioned in the opening, heat waves are the most deadliest natural disaster here in Australia. They kill more people than all other natural disasters combined. But a lot of people don't realise that because it simply doesn't happen straight away. It happens over the next couple of days after the exposure to the extreme heat. You know, for example, the Black Saturday bushfires in Victoria in 2009 killed something like 180 people, but the heat wave immediately before the fires killed almost 380 people. So there's certainly, you know, strong evidence and strong indicators from previous events that we are on this cusp of this health crisis due to extreme heat.
I think when I hear you, Simon, talk about the experiences that you've had in the Northern Territory and Sarah, those points that you make, it strikes me so powerfully that while the impacts of extreme heat from climate change will impact on all of us, there are such fundamentally important equity issues here, and it will be those who are most marginalised, most vulnerable, who are going to be hit hardest and likely hit first, but eventually this will impact on all of us. Anna-Greta had said earlier that the global negotiations are currently looking at whether we end up with a 1.5 degree temperature increase or a 3-degree increase. And we've talked about what that means for temperature variability. Simon, if the global compromise is to accept 3 degrees or perhaps even higher than that, what do you think this is going to mean for Central and Northern Australia where you do your work?
Given how incapable federal and state governments have been to address the extreme inequity in housing and the multidimensional poverty that Aboriginal people live in, I can't see that we are going to be able to support communities through this as it currently stands. We need to have a dramatic change in our expectations of governance around urgent change if Indigenous communities are going to survive. And look, it's the Us non-Indigenous people who live in Australia are a bit lost. We don't have a connection to country like a lot of the people that I know. And I know that most of the Indigenous people I know are deeply connected and highly resistant to even considering having to move elsewhere, because identity is fully contained within the context of the land of which your ancestors belonged. I have been hearing conversations from elders that they're considering what their options are when it comes time to move. And so I think we really need to have a lot more integrity and transparency around conversations. This is a very frightening reality. We don't need to be jumping into we all need to abandon the country in which we stand yet. We need to be taking it iteratively. We need to be having very clear strategic plans for each 5 to 10 year period to figure out how to negotiate. And if we have another summer like the one of 2019-20, and presumably we're going to have worse in the next 5 years, we are at crisis point already. You said before, Sharon, that vulnerable marginalised populations were at great risk. I would say that they're no longer at great risk, but they're actually experiencing exactly what it is that over the last two decades climate scientists have been warning us about.
This issue of equity, I think, is so starkly demonstrated through the Northern Territory experience, and it is absolutely crucial we hear the narratives and stories emerging from our Indigenous populations in the centre of Australia and also from our marginalised communities in our cities around Australia, where the same issues around equity and the increase in vulnerability from the living environment will definitely translate to changes in health outcomes. Intergenerational equity is the other central theme that emerges when we're talking about climate change because of the rate of change. Are we doing enough to prepare for our future? And what should we be doing differently? Sarah, would you like to start with that one?
So as a mother of two young children, soon to be three, I'd say point blankly, no, we are not doing enough. We're not doing enough to protect them from the future. So my children, they'll be 80 in 2100 or thereabouts, and they will experience whether or not we reach 3 degrees Celsius or 5 degrees Celsius or whatever our politicians may think is reasonable. And that infuriates me and as I'm sure it infuriates many other parents. You know, we've been talking about this for 30 odd years. We've been talking about this since I was in primary school, and we've still not done anything about it as a global community. If we had started reducing our emissions effectively 30 odd years ago, imagine where we could be now. And imagine, you know, the advances that would have been made on relying on and storing green energy solutions. You know, we really need to pick up the pace and urgently to get things moving. It's not just encouraging people to do their little bit, whether it's being able to, you know, rely more on fans than energy than air conditioning, for example, or helping marginalised communities adapt better to climate change. We also need to reduce our emissions as well as a global community. And that's a lot easier, and it's, you know, I guess way more practical to do if we have the support and incentives of federal governments. And that's what we currently do not have, and it's seriously lacking. So yeah, we're not doing enough, and we need to do more, and we need to do more yesterday, basically.
And Sarah, you know, on top of that, you know, in jurisdictions like the Northern Territory, let's just open up fracking to the Beetaloo Basin and we'll create a carbon footprint that is extreme. The messaging from our territory government and the enforced circumstances that they financially find themselves because of the federal government and its relation to coal and gas is schizophrenic. They're talking about concern about climate change, and at the same time they're fracking. There is zero integrity in that, and these leaders need to be held accountable for what they're doing to my children's future.
I couldn't agree more. I'm hoping to raise a bunch of very strong, very independent women who fight very hard for their future, because that's certainly what we're going to need a lot more of moving forward.
I've got two of them at my house, Sarah.
Oh, good. They can join forces then. They can lead the world.
I think as I listen to some of these conversations, it is so confronting. You know, it's really difficult to even begin to imagine what the world that we are creating for our children and our grandchildren is going to look like. But we have to imagine it. We have to confront it. I listen to young people talking about these issues, and they take such responsibility for leadership around them, which just indicates to me how our current political leaders are failing so terribly that young people, and often very young people, feel they need to step into that void. This is a conversation that I think we could keep having for much longer, but we're going to have to wrap up. And I have a two-part question for each of you in closing. The first is we always ask around people's number one piece of advice. And so from each of you, what is the number one piece of advice that you would have for climate negotiators as we're going into COP? But I wanted to slip in a second part of that question and ask, how do we prepare our children for the future? And perhaps more importantly, how do we give a sense of hope in the situation that we find ourselves in? Sarah, would you like to have a go at those two tricky questions first?
Yeah, sure. So in terms of the message to governments, particularly our own, basically do more and do better. It's frankly embarrassing what they're not doing here and the schizophrenic activities that they've been undertaking, like Simon has pointed out. It's embarrassing. Grow up, put on your big, you know, big person pants and just get on with the job and listen to the scientists, listen to the experts in many fields to say that this is a problem. Secondly, moving forward with the future. So my kids are still quite young. I haven't had any conversations with climate change about them yet, but I'm sure they're going to happen very soon. My approach is to arm them with as much knowledge and as much practical skills as I possibly can. So, you know, that was one of the reasons why we moved to Canberra. We can lead a more cleaner lifestyle and more energy efficient lifestyle here. And I want to instill in them those practices as best as I possibly can, so they have the skills to reduce their carbon footprints moving forward in the future, as well as, you know, encourage them to standing up for what they believe in and fighting against really poor policies that do nothing for their own future. And I guess in terms of hope, I haven't given up hope. I am pretty angry sometimes, as you can see, about the lack of action, especially in our own country, but I don't give up hope. I can't do my job and not have hope that the future is going to be better. Sure, we probably won't stop at 2 degrees Celsius, but we still have every chance of limiting 3, 4, or 5 degrees Celsius global warming. So there's hope there that the future won't be catastrophic. It won't be as good as what we want, but it's also not going to be, you know, something that we need to give up entirely on.
Simon, what are your thoughts?
Well, in terms of arming negotiators to COP, I would be suggesting that we really need to be putting in a framework of future justice where leaders who do not oblige in doing future generations the right thing right now face the consequences. In terms of hope, I feel more hopeful and less and more hopeless than ever before. But my hope comes from the fact that 15 years ago I stood up in front of a medical audience and asked that every time I spoke in public I would somehow mention climate change. And as a doctor, you're often speaking about some pretty boring topics like pneumonia and heart attacks. And I honoured that commitment. And when I said it publicly in front of an audience at Royal Darwin Hospital, there were sniggers. No one's sniggering at me now. And this isn't a kind of told you so moment. What I find hopeful is that all of a sudden there is unity, particularly spending time on sabbatical in London a few years ago. I saw that collective action can have amazing consequences that are really positive. Scott Morrison and our federal government leave an extraordinary amount to be desired, and they will not be forgotten for what they've left us with. However, I believe that we're on the cusp of massive change, and I'm really genuinely very hopeful that the next 3 or 4 years sees monumental action that I couldn't have imagined a few years ago.
Simon and Sarah, thank you so much for sharing your expertise and your insights with us today. And thank you for sharing that sense of hope, because I think if we are going to fight this challenge that is ahead of us. And if our children are to continue to do so, we need that sense of hope. It's so important. And I think we also need our Prime Minister to represent us at COP26. So let us also hope that that happens and we see some political leadership very soon in this country. But for now, thank you both so much for joining us.
Thanks so much, Sharon. Thanks, Anna-Britta.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Sharon, that was an extraordinary conversation, and I think it's one that we need to continue to go back over. It always strikes me in climate conversations, we speak with almost clinical separation when we imagine a future that is a 3-degree world. I think beginning to humanize that, to begin to understand what that might look like in the places that we love, with the people that we love, in the community that we love, that will be making a tremendous difference in both how we mitigate, how we address our carbon footprint and how we change our polluting practices, but also in how we might adapt and how we might prepare for our future. So I was so grateful to have Simon and Sarah with us today. What were your thoughts?
That was a fantastic conversation, and these are the kinds of conversations that we have to have. I think Sarah explained so clearly that when we're talking about a 1-degree increase, we're not talking about the kind of impact that we have when we go from 16 degrees to 17 degrees here in Canberra on a cold spring day. You know, it's something much more significant than that. And I think people need to understand the meanings of what you rightly describe, Anna-Greta, as those sometimes quite clinical or technical conversations. But the fact that we are having these conversations, and in many parts of the world, we are seeing the kinds of leadership that we need, I think is at least encouraging. So there is a pathway forward. There is hope for the future. But we need to talk, and we need to go beyond talk. We need to act.
Yep, the glimmer of hope of the future. Yep.
Listeners, thank you for joining us today. And as always, thank you for joining us each week. We remind you to connect with us. You can find us on Twitter at APPS Policy Forum, at APPS Policy Forum, or by email on podcast@policyforum.net. You can also join our Facebook group. If you type Policy Forum Pod into the search bar, you'll find us there. We'd love you to subscribe and leave a review on whatever platform you normally pod with. We do read those reviews. We take them very seriously, and we love to hear from you. So please do get in touch. We will be back next week with another episode. But from me, Sharon Bessel, it's bye-bye for now.
And from me, Anna-Greta Hunter, see you next week.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.